A week from tomorrow night, if he didn't get the memo, is forum. And we'll be reading Megillah. There are options. MG's doing a couple of rounds, other shuls coming around, socially distant, masking, all that. If there are those who want an outdoor thing, I could see if we could find something like that. But obviously everything's going to be a little bit chill. But the best way to participate in forum on, you know, is of course, is to learn about it. And we're going to start that tonight. And we begin with the title of class called Hitler and Haman, the Early Years. So this is a little bit different. This is new material here. So first of all, just I'm going to start with an introduction. Everybody's heard of the concept called biblical criticism. If you went to university, you should have learned about that. And if you didn't,
can you explain what that is?
I'm going to do that right now. Biblical criticism is the school of thought, already dating back already close to 200 years already, which is who views the document called the Tanakh as essentially as a human composition. And it was put together, edited together over time, and what we have is a edited document. Okay, so and one of the criticisms about saying this can't be authentic and more as a fable, specifically targeted toward Megillat Esther, is how could it be that there would be one person who would rise to power and want to destroy an entire people? That seemed like crazy stuff. That was one of the, and therefore, and since it's such an exaggeration, such an extreme claim, that would suggest that Megillat Esther is in fact a fable and made up. That criticism from that school of thought was, shall we say, withdrawn tragically with the rise and success, infamous success of Adolf Hitler. Okay. And it's helpful, as we do in general through the senior fellowship, is to be able to see important biblical characters, Jewish characters, from the perspective of contemporary characters. And even though that it's been over 75 years, 76 years since the end of the World War II and the Holocaust, but Hitler, in the heart of every Jew, is somebody who was very alive and well. Everybody is either a child of a survivor or a child of a survivor of a survival, and therefore Hitler casts a large shadow on our people. Has and does and for now, but he is not the first. And we are going to, as an interesting compare and contrasting, we're going to compare the early years of Hitler, and we're going to compare the early years of Haman as seen through the Midrash or the Agadata, which is the Midrashic material put in the Talmud. Okay, and then we're going to compare and contrast that, and then we're going to see what practical applications we can have for our own life. That's our game plan for the next hour. Let's do it. So we'll start, of course. Let's go to the videotape.
Okay. Okay. A different nation. It was still Europe's biggest country, but its militaristic monarchy had gone. It had become a democracy. But its government, the so-called Weimar Republic, was soon struck by a series of hammer blows. Street battles erupted between extreme right-wing nationalists and communists trying to start a revolution. Then, in 1923, the country was devastated by hyperinflation, which reached hundreds of percent a month. Ordinary people's savings were wiped out. This was fertile ground for a new breed of rabble-rousing right-wing politicians. Among them, Adolf Hitler. Hitler had been born in Austria. He had fought bravely as a soldier in World War I and been awarded the Iron Cross. On returning to Germany, he settled in Munich, and his fiery oratory soon enabled him to seize control of the small National Socialist or Nazi Party. In October 1923, Hitler and his henchmen attempted an armed coup against the Weimar government. It failed, and he was sentenced to 9 months. In prison, he wrote a book, Mein Kampf, My Struggle, in which he blamed Germany's ills on the Jews and demanded that it rebuild its strength and seek new territories in the East. On his release, he set about building the Nazis into a proper, disciplined political party. From now on, he would use the democratic system to achieve power. But for the next 5 years, Weimar Germany prospered. Support for extremist parties, left and right, dwindled. Then suddenly, Hitler's opportunity arrived. In October 1929, the US stock market crashed. Billions of dollars were lost, and an economic depression swept across the world. Unemployment in Germany soared to over 6 million. Only extremist politicians seemed to offer a solution.
Wir haben ein Ziel uns gewählt und war festeres fanatisch rücksichtslos.
Politicians like Hitler. By 1931, his Nazis were a true mass movement. And they had their own brown-shirted thugs, the SA stormtroops, who numbered almost 3 million. In the 1932 elections, the Nazis became the largest party in Germany's parliament, the Reichstag. But Hitler refused to join a coalition, leaving parliament paralyzed. To break the impasse, President Hindenburg made him Chancellor in January 1933, head of the government. Within a month, the Reichstag burned down. Hitler accused the communists and demanded emergency powers. He then used them to ban all other political parties. In August 1934, President Hindenburg died. Hitler declared himself president. He was now absolute leader, the Führer of Germany.
Okay. All right. So that's pretty intense. Okay. Let's. All right. Let's. Take a look at this. Okay, so questions. Question number one, after World War I, how many people in Germany, other than Hitler, harbored anti-Semitic feelings?
Hey, Rabbi Finney, I don't think it was so anti-Semitic after World War I during the heyday of the Weimar Republic.
Okay.
I mean, the culture of the Weimar Republic was very like hedonistic and very sure. into the arts and film and theater and writers and intellectuals. It was like a melting pot, right? And where Jews saw themselves as German and they were like kind of like one big melting pot of people.
Right. So that's
suddenly things changed shortly after.
So that question is, when you have the sudden change and such a wave of anti-Semitism, the question is, did it come, what they call in Hebrew, Yesh Mayayin, a creation from nothingness? Or was there a foundationally large undercurrent of a historical anti-Semitism that was a living part of not just German, but European culture? I mean, just
it's
to go.
It's always there.
Yeah, it's always. The bottom line is that the German nation. I mean, first of all, let's break down our various kinds of our various flavors of anti-Semitism. What was the major, just sort of a general question, just to make sure everybody's on the same page. What was a major source of anti-Semitism in Europe for the, you know, the 1,000 years prior to the rise of the Third Reich?
Religious anti-Semitism.
Be more specific.
Like Christian anti-Semitism and the protocols of the Elders of Zion. And
that was much later, but yeah. But 100%. Stephanie is 100% correct. To be in, I mean, you had the Crusades in 1066, which literally communities in Germany and other places in Europe, as the Crusaders were marching from Europe, from England through Europe down to Israel, land of Israel, Jews were put into shuls, which were generally wooden, and were lit on fire. There were shuls, there were communities that were completely wiped out during the Crusades. Then you had people in before the Reformation, you had Roman Catholicism, and Jews were identified as a damned people. They did not accept the the saving grace of Jesus, and therefore not only that, they are responsible for the death of the Messiah and God, even though it sounds sort of like paradoxical, and even though you were not there, but we're responsible. So that was so therefore Jews in Europe, we oftentimes don't think about it, suffered endless persecution. And as a Jew until the emancipation in the 1800s, you as a Jew essentially were a second-class citizen. And if a guy wanted to kill you, they could get away. You can get away with it because fundamentally, as a Jew, you're a condemned person. Okay, there was not real justice for a Jew. Not to mention 1492, we had first Spain, we have the Spain and Portugal kicking out the Jews. Forced conversions. England kicked out the Jews a number of times. France kicked out the Jews, I think, 4 or 5 times. They kicked them out, but they brought them back in. Anybody know? This is another Jewish history question. Why did the French bring the Jews back in 4 or 5 times into their country? They kicked them out because they're Christ killers. So why would they bring them back?
Money.
Money! Because the Jews were allowed in their culture to lend money with interest. And so therefore the Jews were not allowed to do not that much else. So therefore they were the money lenders. So you need capital to run a society. Okay. Anyways, it goes on. So basically when Hitler stepped into the stage, there was not a lot of love for a Jew. Okay. Even though we had the emancipation and you had enlightenment, but that was going back to some of our classes when we had with Herzl. What was Herzl's, this is a little bit of a flashback to previous classes, what was Herzl's awareness about 40 years prior to Hitler?
That we need to assimilate to survive?
Well, that was his initial thought. That's what how are we going to get rid of anti-Semitism? We are going to assimilate. And then he had... Then as a reporter, he recognized what? Shana, you were number two. What did he recognize as a reporter when he went to France under the Dreyfus affair?
That assimilation wasn't the answer. That they were going to hate us whether or not we were like them or not.
Exactly. Theodor Herzl recognized, he thought the solution was, you know how we're going to avoid anti-Semitism? We're going to do mass conversion. We're all going to convert our kids into Lutheranism, the end. Then he recognized it's not going to happen because he saw the Dreyfus affair. So basically the reality is that when Hitler stepped onto the stage, he had many people, every German had varying degrees of dislike or unsavory feelings toward the Jews. Okay. It's just different degrees of, you know, how much they detested them, you know. I'm not saying there were not people, as Jade mentioned earlier, that they got along with them, they worked together with them, and Jews were accepted to be, were allowed to be in the arts and in universities. That will soon change. Okay, now What special talent did Hitler have to be able to build his coalition of the Nazi Party? The video captured many of these things. What were some of his talents?
I was going to say he was a great speaker. That he had a way of drawing crowds, bringing people in. He was a charismatic speaker.
Yes, probably one of the best of the 20th century. What else?
The book that he wrote, Mein Kampf, that also was very influential in getting people swayed to his side.
Yes. In other words, his ideology spoke to, had a very populist and appealing message. You know why we as Germans are now reduced from our former glory? It's the Jews' fault. They stabbed us in the back. If it wasn't for them, we would have won World War I. And the reason we're not the mighty empire that we should be, it's the Jews. And that declaration of ascribing guilt to the scapegoat called the Jews resonated to Germans. Now, not initially. When was he not really so successful?
When he tried to overthrow the government.
Yeah, he tried to overthrow the government, and they threw him in jail. Okay, good. But then, prior to 1929, what did the video point out? Very important.
They had the Great Depression.
Well, no, before the Great Depression, was his popularity rising?
Yeah.
Evan, right. was Germany interested in Adolf Hitler before the Great Depression?
No.
No, because they were living a life of success, and in times of success, extremists, either to the left or to the right, don't have a lot of appeal. Things go bad, when you need somebody who's going to do a radical shift and reordering of the culture, of the government, of the civilization, that's when radical positions, either to the left or the right, start to become more appealing. Question.
I thought that after World War I, Germany was in a bad financial position, though.
Yes, it was. Through from 1919, when they had to, the Treaty of Versailles, when they basically had to pay reparations, they had to pay back the other countries, which was not just, was crippling economically, and also, a demoralizing experience for a very proud nation. That's number one. That's why they had that's part of the reason they had the hyperinflation in 1923. But from 1923 to 1929, the whole world was going through a boom years, and they were living the life of Riley, you know, as they say. So things were going good. And they didn't, you know, when things are good, you don't need Hitler. Then, of course, my question number three is, what events in Germany allowed the virus of anti-Semitism to take over the society completely? The video did a nice way of presenting that. What was the key element? What was his opportunity? What event did he capitalize? A couple of key events were where the virus of anti-Semitism, which is going to be thrust into the body.
Yeah, are you speaking further in time about the shooting, the attempted assassination at the embassy in France?
No, much earlier. Earlier than that. Well, first of all, was the Great Depression. Great Depression. Number one is that now everybody's millions and millions of people have no jobs and they're suffering and they're worried about putting food on the table. It's a terrible time. And they look at their existing government as being weak, ineffectual. And therefore, when you're having a terrible situation, people looking for a scapegoat. Here comes Hitler, the great orator, who gives a whole ideology explaining all your problems. And you know why these problems are? They're not your fault. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's the Jews' fault. Then, added to that, what else happened? He got many seats. He's able to maneuver ruthlessly in the Reichstag. He may have set the fire. He blames it on the communists. The president, Hindenburg, dies. He takes over 1933. He's got full control. And basically, people who are his enemy, he just kills them. He doesn't, you know, he's psychopathic in the sense. He has no problems. So this is the way. So now he starts to control the narrative. And of course, he has Goebbels, his propaganda minister. Then you have the 1933-1934, you have the Nuremberg laws, which of course make the Jews a second class citizen, and Jews can't be in businesses and can't be universities, and the noose for German Jewry and ultimately European Jewry is starting to tighten slowly but surely until, of course, he has absolute control. Then you have, just fast forward, we discussed this in another class, 1941, you have the Wannsee Conference, you have the Final Solution, which of course we have in our own, in our chapter three of our Megillah, where Haman sits down with Ahasuerus and they have a drink. The Germans having drinks. What are we going to do about the Jews? That's a complete foreshadowing. So I want to focus a little bit early. His sort of like we have sort of like described Hitler's early years, his rise to power. Okay. I want to now go to the Megillah, and I want to show you Haman's rise to power as perceived from the eyes of the Amoraim, the authors of the Talmud. Okay, so let's get into the Psukim, and I'm just going to bring everybody in. As you guys know, Achshverosh has a party, 180 days. At the end of the party, has a 7-day party for the people of Shushan. And who else has a party? This is called Megillah 101. Who else has a party?
Vashti.
Vashti. And who's on the invite list on her party?
The ladies.
The ladies of where?
Shushan?
Shushan is correct. This is the local party. The women of Shushan are in the in the part of the palace complex where Vashti's holding forth, and Ahasuerus has the men of Shushan, and he's holding forth. And then on the seventh day, he is getting a little drunk, and what's his request?
Vashti, come before him.
Yes, to what end? For her to give a speech?
I mean, to share
her vision of foreign policy of the Persian Empire.
She's supposed to like appear nude so everyone can see how beautiful she is.
Well,
right?
That is a midrashic approach, but she just has to show her beauty, just to show her beauty in general. Doesn't say that midrashically, they were not the midrash trying to exaggerate the circumstance. She wasn't going to literally be naked, but basically to be an object, to basically be like a beauty pageant. Now, why do you think Vashti refused? Claim shot. Why would she refuse?
Because it was, you know, undignified.
There you go. Because she's the queen. And she's no beauty pageant participant. She's the queen of Persia. And if you want somebody to walk the gangplank, it ain't going to be me. And now she sends back word to Ahasuerus. And now he's in a bind because he said, oh, bring out Vashti. Vashti ain't coming. Now he's been publicly humiliated. And now we got a situation of brakemanship. Who is going to cave? Ahasuerus, Vashti. That's our lead up to the story. Let's go into the, let me get somebody to read. Let me have, who would like to read? All right, Anna wants to read. She just wants to read. Go ahead, Anna.
On the seventh day, when the king was merry with wine, he ordered Mehuman, Beseda, Harbona, Bikta, Abakta, Zathar, and Karkas, the seven eunuchs in attendance on King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king wearing a royal diadem to display her beauty to the peoples and the officials, for she was a beautiful woman.
Okay. What midrash does every kid, I don't care if you went to yeshiva, did go to yeshiva, what's the famous midrash that every kid knows? about Vashti. Why did Vashti refuse? Brought down by Rashi, of course.
Because she has a tail?
She had a tail! Bing! And not only has she a tail, she's supposed to go, but Gavriel, the angel, put a tail to her. Okay.
She was also green or something, maybe.
And she had Esther. You're mixing your midrashim. Okay.
Wait, Esther is green.
Yes, the Hadassah. She's green as a myrtle branch. Okay. There's an idea in that. Okay. Well, we can't do all the midrashim of Megillah Esther. There's rich midrashim, which again you have to know how to learn a midrash. But I'll just convey that basically what those midrashim that are saying that she got sarah, she got leprosy, or she got it through a tail. Fundamentally, the general motif is basically that she would have gone. But basically, the divine, the hand of God, basically made her a situation where she was not going to look her best, you know, as if she was a woman with a tail, which of course is not a nice feature for a woman. Last I checked. So
I'm not sure I agree. I think it could be a significant benefit.
Okay, so Max Sterling is into tails. All right,
you can tell them all I'm into tails.
All right. Okay, we're gonna move on that note. Okay. So let's keep on going there, Anna.
But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's commands conveyed by the eunuchs. The king was greatly incensed, and his fury burns within him.
Yep.
Then the king consulted the sages learned in procedure, for it was the royal practice to turn to all who were versed in law and precedent. His closest advisors were Karshana, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marsina, and Memuchan, the seven ministers of Persia and Media, who had access to the royal presence and occupied the first place in the kingdom.
Okay, so first of all, so that actually is, would you call Ahasuerus a wise king?
Yes.
What's your evidence for that?
That he has advisors for all of the entire kingdom, so he's understanding what's going on in terms of his entire, every province that he's in charge of.
And he doesn't make rash decisions unless he consults expert counsel. So that is a mark of in other words, you can't be running a 127 province empire, i.e. the Persian Empire, if you're an idiot. Okay, it will not happen. But he's the kind of guy, throughout the American presidencies, I'm not going to mention specific names, there are certain presidents that relied more upon their advisors, some relied less on their advisors. Ahasuerus was a little bit heavy on the, you know, he want to enjoy these finer things in life, and sort of he liked to outsource his decisions to his close staff. So he's got a problem now. Vashi's saying no. He's got seven advisors on the case, not one, seven. Let's see what goes on.
Continue.
All
right. What, he asked, shall be done according to law to Queen Vashti for failing to obey the commands of King Ahasuerus conveyed by the eunuchs? Yep. Thereupon, Memuchan declared in the presence of the king and the ministers, Queen Vashti has committed an offense not only against your majesty, but also against all the officials and against all the peoples in all the provinces King Ahasuerus. For the queen's behavior will make all wives despise their husbands, as they reflect that King Ahasuerus himself ordered Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come.
Okay, so stop. So Memuchan's arguing, why does this have to be dealt with in a very serious way? What's going to happen?
Well, the wives are going to disobey their husbands if they see the queen disobeying her husband, getting away with it.
There's going to be a feminist revolution. These women are all getting all uppity. You know, they might, what are they going to want next? Like the vote or something? That cannot happen. So this is an insurrection of the worst kind. The women are now going to be able to disobey and blow off their husbands. And this is going to be a moment of anarchy unless you, Ahasuerus, stand tall as not only as a man and not only as a husband, but a leader of the Persian Empire. Let's see where it goes.
Okay. This very day, the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will cite it to all your majesty's officials, and there will be no end of scorn and provocation. If it please your majesty, let a royal edict be issued by you, and let it be written into the laws of Persia and Media so that it cannot be abrogated, that Vashti shall never enter the presence of King Ahasuerus, and let your majesty bestow her royal state upon another who is more worthy than she. Then will the judgment executed by your majesty resound throughout your realm, vast though it is, and all wives will treat their husbands with respect, high and low alike.
Yep.
The proposal was approved by the king and the ministers, and the king did as Memucan proposed. Dispatches were sent to all the provinces of the king, to every province in its own script, and to every nation in its own language, that every man should wield authority in his home and speak the language of his own people.
Okay. All right. Now,
that's a weird addendum, huh?
What do you mean by what's the weird addendum?
That you wield authority in the home and you speak your own language.
No, that the woman has to speak the guy's language. So apparently, you see that there was. Apparently, in the within the Persian Empire, there was sort of a intermingling of between various tribes and factions, and also languages and dialects. So who has to defer to whom? Do I got to learn French, or does she have to learn English? No, she's got to learn whatever the guy's language is. I think that's the plain understanding. But basically. So first of all, the question is, what advice did Memucan suggest to Ahasuerus, and what problem did it solve? And also, I would say, I would add a third part to it, and was it a wise decree or wise idea? Pshat. I'm looking for Pshat answers, guys.
Well, the shot, I guess, is that Vashti is ordered to never be in King Ahasuerus' presence ever again and be replaced by someone else.
Yeah. So, by the way, how does Chazal learn that? That's a veiled way of saying what's happening to Vashti.
She's being killed.
She's being killed. Not that she is now getting into her Rolls Royce and tooling away.
Going to a farm upstate,
right? Not going to a farm upstate to repair and for her last years of forced retirement for years of reflection. No, you get essentially divorced or evicted from being the queen. You become dequeenized by the removal of your head from your body. That's how Chazal understand that, even though it's not overtly mentioned, okay? So Vashti basically is not only fired and not only dismissed, but she is dismissed from this world. Okay, so that's I don't think it's a far-flung midrashic approach. I think that's a understanding which is fairly close to the pshat. Okay, all right, go on. So What problem did Ahasuerus have? I want to hear some new voices. I'm going to call him Daphne. What was Ahasuerus' problem? What was Memucan's solution?
I don't know. I think Ahasuerus' problem is he's not a very smart king. He's very insecure.
Yep.
The reaction to the to this offense was so blown out of proportion. In a way, it made him look weaker. And, having your political advisors suggest that you behead someone in such a manner. And then I guess the decree that now everybody has to learn the same language in the house, I don't think it solved any problems. I think it made problems a lot worse. If you have that many people telling you what to do, you have no strong opinions of your own.
All right. So better yet, what was the proposed, in his mind and all the, what problem was it allegedly solving?
Well, it made him look like better. It made him look like, I guess, in his mind, it made him look strong.
Right. Now, in order for Memucan, but what really is going on? Is this a problem you bring in your state advisors in?
No.
What kind of problem is this really?
Domestic.
Yeah, it's a problem. It's a Shalom Bayit problem.
And now there is a Shalom Bayit. Like now, no one has Shalom Bayit.
Right, so it's like you know, you have the husband and wife are in an ego battle with each other, are not being deferential to each other. Each person is wanting to, you know, maintain their personal dignity, and he overstepped his bounds because he got a little drunk, and he felt very proud about the fact that he's got a hot wife, and he wants everybody to see that, so he wants her to show her off, and she found that to be absolutely degrading. And she is not a prostitute. So we got a problem. So this is not something you bring in your, you know, you bring in the cabinet for. Okay. So, but he did. And the way that they solved it, they expanded as being, this is not what Mamukhan did in a rather slick move. This is not a localized problem between a husband and a wife who can't get along. Chas v'shalom. What we have here is we have a possibility of an insurrection of epic proportion that affects every household in the entire Persian Empire. And because basically, if Vashti gets away with this, you're going to have that basically every wife will not be deferential, will not listen to. This is you know, using the language of today, this is a very patriarchal world. And basically, the woman is not, shall we say, an equal in the house. She is a second-class citizen in the house. And that was apparently very frightening to this culture. So therefore, you got to show who's boss. You got to put on your big boy pants and put your boot down and make sure that we don't have insurrections in all homes. Now, the reality is that you cannot legislate anything from a governmental standpoint to what, how people are going to live when people, when the doors are shut. You know what I mean? The a person's shalom bias cannot be mediated, you know, from on a federal level. It's just a joke. But you know, Mamukhan saved Ahasuerus's feeling weak, at least perceiving himself weak. He claimed it as being that now Ahasuerus is the savior of all men, stopping this feminist insurrection, and everything is great, okay? And everybody bought it, okay? It seemed reasonable, okay? Now, here we go. So Mamukhan, so the plain text, who's Mamukhan? Who's Mamukhan?
An advisor.
He's a Persian advisor.
Geez, I just blanked on his name.
So you're going to find out in 12 seconds. Here we go. We're going to go to the Talmud. We'll go to the Gemara. Okay. So let me have somebody read. All right, Max Sterling.
Are you saying Mamukhan's Haman?
Go on. I'm not saying anything. Check out the Gemara. Read it out.
Megillah 12b. The verse states, and Mamukhan said, Esther 1:16, a sage taught in a Baraita. Mamukhan is Haman. And why is Haman referred to as Mamukhan? Because he was prepared, Mukhan, to bring calamity upon the Jewish people. Rav Hanana said, from here we see that the common man jumps to the front and speaks first. For Mamukhan was mentioned last of the king's seven advisors, and nevertheless, he expressed his opinion first.
Okay. But leaving Rav Hanana's point off for a moment, so what the heck is that? How does this, this Tana, what is this, a Tana? This, you know, from the Brisa, this Amora claim, and this is an idea which is embraced by not just this Amora, this, you know, sage in the Talmud, but many other sages, as we're going to soon see from the Midrash. Why from a literary standpoint, from any standpoint, would you think, imagine that Mamukhan is really Haman? Why would you think that?
Wouldn't, I don't know.
Is it an anagram?
No, it's not an anagram.
I'm trying over here.
Just pictured ordering Mamukhan Tosh.
So So what do you guys say, guys? I mean, why would they come up with this idea? Okay, so
because he gives the worst advice, like with this conviction that he couldn't possibly be wrong.
Right. In other words, it sounded sophisticated, but really was something which was harmful to the empire, which of course, Haman's later suggestions, Ahasuerus, to kill all the Jews would be the similar vein. Good. I think that's one idea. I think that's a fair observation. What else?
He was the most audacious, it sounds like, from the
line. So you see,
he was last of the advisors, but expressed his opinion first.
All right, so so what Rav Kahana points out, this guy is a young upstart. He's the least senior of all the advisors, yet he's talking first. When you're not senior, the most important thing to do is be quiet, okay? And let everybody else, because whoever talks more loses. That's true in life in general, but that's, so he talked first. He very, very aggressive in his viewpoint and his stance, etc.
He's leaning in.
I, the plain point is, because we go to the next chapter, chapter 3, and it says that Ahasuerus promoted Haman. So we have no backstory. You know what I'm saying? So it seems reasonable that, and why would Ahasuerus do that? So apparently he is promoting him because he is an audacious, apparently another way, good advisor of somebody that he values. So therefore, to identify that he's midrashically the same guy makes more sense from a literary standpoint, that you have the prime mover within Ahasuerus' court is one guy, not two separate dudes. Okay? You know what I'm saying? So that's the literary reason to say. In other words, unite them because the main force, Mamukhan, is that he's doing, as also Daffy said, is ambitious, aggressive, very assertive. It's the same persona of Haman. But now we're gonna sweeten it by now the question. Now, where is Memuchan means, from the word Muchan means prepared. So he's Memuchan for calamities. Now now there's gonna be a three-way debate among the Amorim, which we're now gonna explore, about why did he do this? In other words, he basically, why would this guy suggest that basically the king kill the queen? That's a very aggressive, assertive, and also, by the way, dangerous. There's a little bit of a danger. What is what's Mamukhan's downside? What if things go bad?
Well, what if Ahasuerus loves his wife and is like, you suggest that I kill my wife? Like, who are you to suggest that? Like, it could be or even if he doesn't love that, like, who are you to interfere in my marriage that way?
Exactly. And in the ancient world, and it's funny, in the ancient world and in the same place, Shushan is Sura. It's in Iraq. We're talking about the place where Islamic, we're talking about places where tribal fiefdoms would do these, will kill people when they feel they're not doing the right thing. You know, killing people in that part of the country, part of the world, till today is not something which is too unusual. People get killed all the time for a lot less.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Where it says a sage taught in a baraita, and then it continues on, bringing calamity to the Jewish people. Where does that come from?
So this is the Gemara, and it says a sage. It doesn't tell us the name of the sage. It just says Vahatanya. We learn in a baraita. It doesn't tell us who it was, and it just says Mamukhan to Haman. That Mamukhan is Haman. Oh, so so then the question is, what's the implied question of the Gemara? Oh, so if he's Haman, just say the number seventh guy. Did she call him Haman before? They mentioned his name for the last seven chapters of six chapters of the Megillah. Put his name there. From a midrashic standpoint, he's called Mamukhan because he is prepared.
But where did the calamity upon the Jewish people come from? Like, where did that come? That part.
Well, he's Mukhan, or he is prepared to, because in the next chapter 3, he rises to power. when he has access, he says, let's get rid of the Jews. Okay. So he's like, he's ready to, you know, that's already your number one, that's your number one parallel to Hitler. Mm-hmm. Hitler, when he's sitting in jail, writing Mein Kampf, he is fantasizing about living in a Germany, which is Judenrein, Jew free. Even though everybody looked at him as a kook, as a crazy person. Your dream is you're insane. And you know, he had the last laugh. Okay, let's go on to the Midrash. Mm-hmm. Let's explore. Okay,
I mean, there's also the parallelism too, right? Like the consequence of like not killing Vashti is also the consequence of like, or the threat that the Jews pose as well, right? That somehow they are, that'll be like disempowering, like that the Jews will threaten the nation.
Well, he says there is a nation. And as Dasamech lo osim, they don't follow the king law. They are yeah. disloyal, which is the primary, one of the major claims of Mein Kampf. The Jews are stabbed Germany in the back. Let's go on to the Midrash, running out of time.
Oh, no, but it's just to say, like, this is the same argument in a way he's making against Vashti.
Correct. It's a similar vein, similar approach, which again supports the Haman, Memuchan equals Haman theory. All right, yeah. Okay, Max, keep on going here. Read it out.
Thereupon, Memuchan declared, Rabbi Yochanan said, the Amoraim have three explanations of why did Memuchan Haman present such a harsh decree against Vashti. One said, because she struck him sideways with her shoe on his face on both this way and that. Another said, because she did not notify his wife of the banquet for women. And another said, because he had a daughter and he was seeking to marry into the kingdom. On what basis did he say, because she struck him sideways with her shoe on his face on both this way and that? He said, Queen Vashti has committed an offense not only against your majesty.
Which is suggesting that not only did she offend you, Achashverosh, but she also offended him. We'll get to that. We're going to unpack these things carefully. Go on.
On what basis did another say, because she did not notify his wife of the banquet for women? He said, for the queen's behavior will make all wives despise their husbands. On what basis did another say, because she was his daughter? And he was, because he had a daughter. And he,
right, he had
not,
a daughter.
Not the she, right?
Right, because she, right, because.
No, she, because he had a daughter and he was seeking to marry him into the kingdom. He said, bestow her royal state upon another who is more worthy than she is.
Okay, which obviously is like, where that's a little bit, that's going, you know, why he said, you know, the question was what to do with Vashti, not to provide a suggestion of what should happen post Vashti. So the fact that he's already suggesting something else implies that he had a larger plan. He had a larger vision that he wanted to share to Achashverosh. Okay. All right. We answered five. All right, so let me unpack each one of these theories here. But let's just unpack each one. So I want to make it more. Let me ask you guys a question. What is the common denominator between all three of the Amoraim's theories about Haman? You have three theories. Theory number one is that Vashti, at some point in time, hit her with her slipper on his face this way and that. Now, if you guys know about the Middle East to this very day, I don't know if you guys remember when Saddam Hussein was overthrown by the United States forces and they knocked down his statue. Does anyone remember what all the Iraqis were doing to that statue? For our Western eyes, it seemed
like they were hitting him with their shoes.
Exactly.
Scott Shapiro. Didn't the reporter?
Yeah. So what does that mean? Hitting with a shoe, being struck by your shoe, to this very day, is the ultimate disgrace. How do you disgrace somebody in ancient Iraq and, you know, and ancient Persia and apparently modern Persia? You hit somebody with the dirty part of your shoe. So apparently already Haman got into some sort of issue with her, and smacked him on his face this way and that with her shoe. Okay, we have to unpack that.
Also, just an inability to deal with any kind of humiliation. I mean, even if that's culturally so, but the response of murder is so, I don't know, it's just like very much like a violence against women kind of thing. When men are humiliated and don't know how to deal with it, it's always like, kill her.
Yeah.
So.
Yes. Yes. True. So let's, we have to work it out like it. You have to work it out like a chess game. This is my, Evan. In other words, you got to work backwards. Okay, let's work it back. In other words, so if she smacked him with her shoe, why did Vashti would do that? Let's work out backwards.
He probably deserved it.
Okay, but I understand that. But remember, Vashti is a savvy woman. What is she trying to do? Come on, you got to think like a political a strategist here.
Well, she's basically asserting that she has more power than Haman or something.
So therefore, you have to assume that she's responding to what?
Provocation on his part.
Yeah.
He's just as powerful in the court, just as close to the ruler.
Yeah, no, basically, she sensed that this dude is moving in to create a bromance with her husband, aka the king. And what is she doing? She's knocking him down.
She's trying to outmaneuver.
Outmaneuver and knock him down. In other words, in the corporate ladder, which is the Ahasuerus and Vashti's world, there are people, you're moving up the ladder and you're trying to avoid him getting knocked down. So what does she try to do? This guy's like, who the heck is this guy? He's trying to move on in. He's trying to build a coalition with Ahasuerus. So what does she do? She humiliates him. Hey, dude, back off, buddy. You're a schlepper. You're a servant. And that's what basically she's saying. You're a nobody. Get the hell out of here. That's what she basically is doing. She's asserting her sense of dignity and also what? Power. This is power politics in a raw, unvarnished way. This is it. This is a welcome to a Machiavellian world. Okay? That is the world of Ahasuerus and Vashti and Haman. Okay? It's about the power. It's about and what happens to your enemies? You kill them, and you have no problem with that. And by the way, the world has not, this orientation of the world has not, in many ways, changed for many parts of the world. Okay, all right. This is not Jeffersonian democracy here. This is power politics, Machiavellian, and basically she sees him as a threat, so she humiliates him. And therefore, and now from that perspective, in other words, the Amora, the Talmudic sage is positing that because he sees that if you're going to, let's do it logically. Let's do it. It's again, this is it's a chess move. Move one. If Mamukhan is Haman, and Haman suggests a murderous suggestion that we got to get rid of Vashti. So he must be responding to an aggression on her part. So she probably did one theory. She humiliated him by doing the Middle Eastern slipper smackdown, and therefore he wanted to put her. You're gonna put me into my place? No, I don't think so. So therefore he had the ultimate chess move back at her. Shall we say? She's taking down the queen. Okay, chess is, by the way, a Machiavellian drama on 64 squares. Okay, taking down the queen, capture the king. That's it. Okay, it's ultimately a vicious fight, and you have to outmaneuver your guy. Evan, am I right about that?
100%.
Okay, I got all right. I feel good. All right, so that's it. That's theory one. Theory two is, why did he suggest this murderous suggestion? What happened? Who got left on the invite list of all the women of Shushan? Who got invited? Everybody.
Mrs. Mnuchin.
Yeah, Mrs. Haman, otherwise known, what's her name later on in the Megillah?
Oh.
Come on, guys. Come on. You're killing me. What's her name?
Oh.
Zeresh.
Oh, yeah.
Zeresh apparently did not get the invitation. The paperless post did not arrive. Mail was not being dropped off that day. Why would, if it's an invitation for all the women of Shushan, why would Mrs. Haman, Zeresh, not get the invite?
Because Vashti doesn't like her husband.
Yeah, so it's a, so the first shot is active aggression. You're going to mess with me? I'm going to actively humiliate you. Then this is the one which is where I would say men do, but women are do it in a far more artful way.
We're the best at being
passive aggressive. Passive aggression! All right. Haman, you think you're special? Okay. Guess who's going to be sitting home watching Netflix by herself when every single woman in the neighborhood and in the town is at the big event? Not one day, 7 days. She's sitting at home. You can't get in without a ticket. No ticky, no surety. You're not getting into it. So that's also a smackdown, but through the passive-aggressive approach. Third approach, Haman had a daughter. We know about Haman's 10 sons, but apparently he had a daughter. What's his idea? What's that approach?
He will marry her into royalty.
That's it. Well, I want to get in with Ahasuerus. The best way is to create a marriage of convenience. And therefore, I am now mishpacha. I'm in. My access to power has been solidified. Okay. Does this sound ruthless? It is. Okay. Now let's. So, what is the common denominator between all the Amorim theories? What's the common denominator?
Well, they all benefit Haman and
they all have an ulterior motive.
Well, yeah. Of course, they're all yes.
He does whatever he has to do to accomplish his mission.
He has a long game.
He has the long game. And what's the objective of his game? He has one objective, which
power.
Is
power.
Power through what means?
Any means.
Whatever means necessary.
No. Is he suggesting to overthrow the king?
No. I think he would if he was.
This, by the way, this is where he's different from Hitler. Hitler was ultimately interested in getting rid of Hindenburg. God took care of that by Hindenburg's an old dude, died. Okay? And then he just took power. Okay?
I think if Haman thought he could get rid of Ahasuerus, he would.
Could be. But no, but his approach was what? Build a
second in command. Like he wanted to be his chief advisor, basically.
Yeah.
Like the Iago to the Othello.
Exactly. In other words, he wants to be the number two dude. In other words, he's not trying to become the number one. He's trying to fuse himself to the king and therefore ensure that he can utilize the king to get his end done, which ultimately by chapter three is the genocidal destruction of the entire Jewish people. Okay. So that's all. This is it. So Haman is a very dangerous person, crafty, and a Machiavellian character. Now, let's don't forget, how was this decree against Vashti ultimately a blessing?
Led Esther to get in.
Yes.
Created a power vacuum for Esther.
Correct. In other words, the Talmud says that Hashem sends the refuah, the healing, before the makkah, before the sickness. In other words, Haman and Ahasuerus are operating in their power politics prism, but a Kadosh Baruch Hu, Hashem, ultimately is maneuvering things for the Jewish people. By clearing Vashti off the stage, allowing for the future woman of salvation, Esther, to come and become the queen, and therefore ultimately to provide to save the Jews. Now, we get to our essence of our conversation. This is all really coming to get to the essence of the Shir. It really is question number eight to see how is Haman like Hitler in the early years and how is he different? How is Haman like Hitler in his later years? What are the? Let's compare and contrast. And there are many points. Let's stack them all up here. How is Haman like Hitler in the early years? I mean, I'm assuming that we're going to take the Midrashic assumption that Haman is Mamuchan, et cetera. How are they like each other?
Sorry, what do you mean by early years? Like before
in their climbing to power, not when they become their most powerful.
Both were trying to endear themselves to those who had power.
Yes.
At the beginning.
Yes. Although Hitler tried, first he tried a coup approach and then got smacked down. Then he said, no, I'm going to work within the system. I might get further. But first of all of them, both Haman and Hitler, were absolutely driven to a singular goal, and everything else is instrumental. There is no morality. All there is power. Everything is, and anybody who gets in your way is killed. Did you guys hear about the Knight of the Long Knives? Which is one knife, one knight, he dispatches his SS and basically assassinates all of his enemies. Okay? So Haman would do that, no problem. Haman kills Vashti. Mamuchan knows that Vashti is not deserving of being executed. Does he care?
No.
No. Because she is from the way that we presented tonight, from the perspective of the Midrash, she is going to be like going back to the Evan Rabin's, we're going chess thing. Sometimes you need to sacrifice the queen to win the game. Okay. And Haman had no problem with that. She's going down because I'm here to win the game. I don't care how many pawns have to get slaughtered. Knights, rooks, bishops, they're all going down because all he cares about, he's an egomaniac. All mm-hmm. he cares about is his power, his hegemony, his control. Now, how is he different than Haman, Hitler? Haman is a little different than Hitler. There's a difference, very big difference. Shayna.
Hitler wanted to be the sole person in power, whereas Haman seems to be okay being number two to Ahasuerus.
Correct. That's a very important distinction. There's two strategies. One approach is that, you know, it could be that I don't want to have the hassle of the entire empire, okay? Or I don't feel I can really pull this off. But I'm very comfortable sort of trying to ingratiate myself to the king and become number Shane Lamelech, number two to the king, and therefore use my access to tremendous success. So that's a very important stage. Now we go, of course, to get it clear. How is Haman like Hitler in his later years? Here's all the obvious points.
Blame the Jews.
Okay. Blame the Jews as disloyal. Convince the people that the destruction of the Jews is in everybody's best interest. Go ahead and try to execute a genocidal plan. The difference between Hitler and Haman, Haman was not successful, and Hitler was, or at least partially.
But do you think Haman would have blamed anyone just to get to power? It seems Hitler is more dangerous in that he believes in what he's saying versus maybe Haman is saying this just because it will get him there.
So,
not saying that he wasn't a horrible anti-Semite and it was a close call with genocide, but it was...
Well, do they go into why Haman hated the Jews?
So, what event? Again, this is a Megillah 101. 101.
Mordechai wouldn't bend down.
Yeah.
Yes.
Is it really? Is that really where it stems from? Is that, or is
Let's go deeper on that. So you see by his reaction. So if he has an ego battle with Mordechai, just use your influence to get Mordechai killed.
Right.
He says it was despicable to attack Mordechai because he knew about Am Mordechai, because he recognized, because what the anti-Semite has is on a very profound sense, they have a sense about the reality of the Jew. Let me explain this a little bit. Is that he recognizes not Mordechai. Mordechai is not a one guy, one individual dude. Mordechai is embodying a philosophy, an ideology that maintains as a creator. And it looks at the reason that Mordechai did not bow to him, it says, Lo kam velo zah. He was motionless. Why? Because Mordechai radiated that Haman is insignificant. You are living in a insane reality of your own making, and you're a nothing. And deep down, Haman knows that Mordechai is right. And deep down, he knows that the God of Israel, there's a reality to that, and it makes him crazy. And so what's the solution? It's the final solution. Simple. There'll be no more Jews. No more Jews. No more God of the Jews. Nothing that's going to impede my sense of absolute greatness. Nothing's going to disturb my sense of absolute power. And mm-hmm. and you see that when he was invited, and he sees that he says he can't enjoy. He gathers all after the first party. He gathers Esther. Esther invites him, and then he comes home and he sees that Mordechai won't bow again. He gathers his wife and his friends, and he talks about his wealth and his power and his 10 kids. And he says, "Because it ain't a shovely. All this means nothing to me when I see Mordechai." What do you mean? Why are you denying the blessings of your life? Because he's trying to be a certain Superman figure. He has an egotistical sense of himself. And when he comes in contact with Mordechai, the image shatters. And it's simply intolerable. Mm-hmm. And he knows it's not just Mordechai. It's the Jewish people. Hitler said, the Jewish people came to circumcise the world. And I'm here to undo that. In other words, Hitler looks at the Jews as a person, as a nation who is bringing a morality to the world, which is untenable. He wanted to create a nation, which is fundamentally going back to the Roman. He wanted to create a Roman Empire, pagan, power politics. We're victorious gladiators. That's his interest. So let's put it all together. So therefore, what does ongoing anti-Semitism and the mitzvah to destroy Amalek call upon us to do? It's not just Haman. Haman is the exemplar of Amalek, a nation, or as we explained last night in my Parsha class, it's not limited to a tribe, but a people whose ideology is who find the existence of the Jew simply intolerable. That's the Nazi regime. And what I want to share is that we have an obligation. It's not just hearing Parsha Zachor, but it's not being a once-a-year Jew and hearing about what Amalek tries to do. There's an ongoing battle between the people who despise the Jewish people, and we have to remain vigilant because Amalek is not, in essence, the spirit of Amalek lives on. And therefore, things that we need to do, we need to support the IDF and lone soldiers who are doing the job of ensuring the Amalek of today is the Iranian regime that wants to literally destroy. If they would have nuclear warhead, they would use it without compunction, either through themselves or through their proxies. So therefore, we as Jews have to become, we have to, what we can do, we can't fight Amalek. It's really a national thing. It's really incumbent upon essentially the state of Israel. But to support the IDF in every way, or lone soldiers, this is just one example. Get involved in organizations that combat anti-Semitism. Get involved, become educated. I just put one of many. Combat Anti-Semitism is an organization that gathers all the anti-Semitic attacks that are happening to the Jewish people on a daily basis. You can check out their website, sent you the sheet today. And of course, something that I said yesterday is that every Jew, no Jew is safe. I don't care what in America Yesterday's class, we talked about the three innocent people that were killed in the Jewish grocery store in Jersey City. A guy had written an anti-Semitic manifesto, and him and his girlfriend came in with shotguns and shot three people, two Jews, because they were Jews. That's it. And then that later that month, as long as 2 years ago, an anti-Semitic person was stabbing people at a Hanukkah party. There's been a lull because of COVID.
Right.
It was last year. Yeah. But so the bottom line is that we are, and then we had the attack against the shul in Halle, Germany. So the bottom line is that a Jew has to be has to defend themselves, and this organization Legion, which teaches Krav Maga, basic self defense skills, to be supportive of helping Jews protect themselves, their institutions. There are many ways to do this, but my point is that we live in a world of Hamans. To think that evil is something from the far from the world far away is a fantasy. And we remind ourselves this Shabbos, Zachor, Amalek. Remember what Amalek did, because Amalek is with us. And we have, and nowadays we in America, we have anti-Semites on the left and we have anti-Semites on the right. We have on every side. You got your Proud Boys. You got your white supremacists who are virulently anti-Semitic. You have your anti-Semites on your left. We have Iran. We have Hezbollah. We have Hamas, and we have all these various people who would love to complete Haman's mission. Or Hitler's mission. And we have Jews have to cannot get lulled into a state of complacency. We have to become educated. We have to support those who are fighting the good fight. And there's no one silver bullet. And we have to be able to be engaged in personal self-defense, because one of the most humiliating thing was, where various thugs are going through Brooklyn and beating up, Hasidim, because they are defenseless. That is something that is not a Jewish ideal. When Avram heard that his nephew had been abducted in a regional war, he had a militia of 318 men. He went in the middle of the night in a midnight raid. He went, he killed and rescued his nephew Lot. Unfortunately, when the Jewish people lived in Europe, we weren't able to defend ourselves because we were under the authority, aggressive authority of the various regimes. We have an obligation to defend ourselves, and you can't outsource it. You can't say like, well, we'll call the cops and they're going to come. No, now I'm not saying maybe we have to hire private guards, private security system, security. My shul, since that event 2 years ago, has every Shabbos has a off-duty police officer armed, guarding the shul, because the bottom line is, even though these issues have fallen off the front pages, it's a reality. And that's part of the message, is that Haman is a reality. And we are hopeful that we will get the benefit of a Mordechai and Esther who will save the day. But the first step of saving the day is taking, partnering with Hashem and taking self-defense and the defense of the Jewish people as a reality and as a priority. And that's a basic message. And evil is a reality, and anti-Semitism is not going away anytime soon. And that's the message of Parshas Zachor and part of the message of Purim. Anyway, and we have, ladies and gentlemen, Rabbi Mark Wild.
Thanks, guys. By the way, anybody interested in fulfilling the mitzvah by coming to shul and actually hearing the Torah being read, we will be laying it at MJE this Shabbat, Parshas Zachor, as we do every year.